More of our favorites from the archives as we celebrate Insight's 15th birthday. Today, we'll revisit a compelling conversation about race with historian Richard Rothstein, author of The Color of Law. He talked with reporter Cosmo Garvin. Cheryl Cashin joined us on the subject of whiteness and what she calls interracial intimacy in America. She had written about her work in a book and a New York Times essay. And stay with us for Colson Whitehead. When he was on Insight in March of 2017, his novel, The Underground Railroad, had just won the National Book Award for Fiction. Colson's 2019 book is titled The Nickel Boys. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. In this hour, we'll focus on race and segregation in America. In September of 2017, we aired a conversation with Professor Richard Rothstein, senior fellow at the Haas Institute at UC Berkeley School of Law. He had just written his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. He talked with reporter Cosmo Garvin about the history of policies that resulted in segregated communities in California and across the United States.
Many federal, state, and local policies that created residential segregation, but I think the two most important were first the civilian public housing program, which was begun in the New Deal to address a housing shortage primarily for white middle-class, lower-middle-class families who had lost their homes in the Depression. And the federal government, beginning with the Public Works Administration, created segregated public housing projects, separate projects for whites and blacks. Most were for whites, few were for blacks, in cities across the country, frequently creating segregation in cities which had never known segregation before. Langston Hughes, for example, talks in his autobiography about how he grew up in an integrated neighborhood in Cleveland. His best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl. The neighborhood in Cleveland where he lived was integrated, as were many neighborhoods in cities, north and south at that time, because working families didn't have automobiles and they had to be able to walk to work. Well, the neighborhood that Langston Hughes grew up in was demolished by the Public Works Administration in order to build two separate projects, one for African Americans, one for whites. In other cities, neighborhoods were demolished, integrated neighborhoods, and public housing was built for white families only, and African Americans were left to fend for themselves in other tenement districts, which they wound up overcrowding. So in many cities, this happened. In World War II, workers, both white and black, flocked to centers of defense production to work in manufacturing ships and tanks and airplanes. The federal government had to provide housing for these workers because the cities had exploding populations as workers flocked to work in defense plants. And again, the federal government created segregation with housing for workers' families in places that had never known it before. Richmond, California, for example, which became one of the largest black ghettos in the state of California, was an all-white community before World War II. But the federal government built housing for blacks along the railroad tracks near the industrial area, housing for whites in the residential areas, creating a segregated pattern that remained for decades afterwards. So that was one policy of the federal government. The second policy, which was perhaps even more powerful, was the Federal Housing Administration, an agency of the federal government that was also formed in the New Deal in 1934, provided subsidies to builders of mass production developments, suburbs. And they provided these subsidies by guaranteeing bank loans for builders to build subdivisions on condition, and this was an explicit federal condition, that no homes be sold to African Americans. Perhaps the best known of these is Levittown, just east of New York City, 17,000 homes. The Levitt family could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes for which they had no buyers. The only way they did so was by getting bank guarantees from the federal government on condition that they sell no homes to African Americans, and a further condition that they place language in every deed of every home in Levittown prohibiting resale to African Americans. And this was true everywhere in the country. Daly City, Westlake, south of San Francisco, Lakewood, south of Los Angeles, Panorama City in the Los Angeles area. All of these giant subdivisions were built with Federal Housing Administration requirements that no homes be sold to African Americans. Well, you put these two programs together, African Americans and whites in public housing, and these FHA policies that suburbanized the country, come the 1950s, when the civilian housing market began to recover, whites began to leave public housing in order to occupy the single-family homes to which they were being subsidized by the federal government in suburbs. Eventually, public housing became all African-American or predominantly African-American because the African-Americans had no option to leave central cities. The whites did. And so you have the situation as a result of these two federal government policies where a white noose was created around central cities with suburbs from which African-Americans were excluded and African-Americans increasingly given no housing options outside the neighborhoods where public housing and tenement districts were located.
Today, we think of the New Deal as being this liberal set of policies or this progressive set of policies. We don't think of the New Deal as being a tool for segregation. So is that what you mean in the subtitle of your book when you say this is a forgotten history?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean, because this wasn't a hidden history. It was well known at the time. There's nothing hidden about it. The Federal Housing Administration's manual told appraisers that they couldn't appraise a home for a mortgage at the low risk of mortgage guarantee if it was in a neighborhood where African Americans might live. At one point, the Federal Housing Administration, in my book, The Color of Law, I have a picture of this. The Federal Housing Administration required the developer of a white subdivision to build a 6-foot-high cement wall separating the development from a nearby African-American neighborhood, and only then would the FHA insure the mortgages in that development and guarantee the construction loans. So it was well known. Public housing that was segregated. It's not that African-Americans happened to apply to some projects and whites happened to apply to others. The projects were specifically designated by race. So it has been a forgotten history. And because it's been forgotten, we're hobbled in our ability to deal with issues of racial segregation because the conventional myth that this all happened by accident and by private prejudice and personal choices, if that's really how it happened, it's very difficult to think of how you could have a similar number, millions of private choices and prejudicial actions to undo it. If we understand that it was actually created by the federal government with state and local government support, then we can easily begin to talk about ways that the federal government can equally undo segregation that it created. So something that was done by public policy can be reversed by public policy. Something that was just done by accident, it's hard to figure out how to reverse it.
So these explicitly discriminatory practices are 50 years in the past now, and yet these patterns of segregation persist, even in a city like Sacramento, which I understand is comparatively better integrated than many cities. We still see these patterns. So why do they persist?
Well, the policies of residential segregation are much more embedded and difficult to reverse than other segregation policies. When we abolished segregation on buses, for example, the next day an African-American could sit anywhere he or she wanted on a bus. When we abolished segregation in restaurants, the next day anybody could go into a restaurant and be served. When we abolished segregation in schools, if a law had been enforced, African-Americans could go to their neighborhood school, regardless of what the majority race in that school was. If we were to abolish segregation in housing, which the government equally created, it's hard to figure out what happens next. Can African-Americans suddenly pick up and move to all-white suburbs from which they've been excluded? No, that's very difficult. In fact, it's virtually impossible. In the mid-20th century, when these massive subdivisions were created, places like Levittown and Panorama City and Lakewood and Daly City, when those subdivisions were created, those homes sold for about $8,000-$10,000 a piece. At today's currency, that's about $100,000. $100,000 then was about, in today's currency, was about twice national median income. Working class families, whether black or white, could have afforded to buy those homes. Working class whites did. Working class African Americans were forced to live in apartments in central cities, not permitted to move to suburbs. Today, those homes that sold for $100,000 to working class families 60 years ago, they sell now for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. That's 7-8 times national median income. They're now unaffordable to working class families, black or white. So although we passed the Fair Housing Law saying that, okay, African Americans, you can now move to these suburbs from which the federal government previously excluded you, it didn't do much to undo the past segregation because those homes are now unaffordable to working class families. Even middle class families, white and black, can no longer afford to move to single family homes in the suburbs. Today, nationwide, African-American incomes are about 60% of white incomes. African-American wealth is only about 5% of white wealth on average. And that enormous difference, a 60% income ratio, a 5% wealth ratio, is almost entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy in the mid-20th century. And we need to be creative in figuring out how to reverse that, because its effects endure today in this enormous wealth gap and in the concentration of African Americans, many African Americans in cities, and the suburbanization of the white population.
A few years back, when I first learned about your research, was when you wrote an article called The Making of Ferguson, and you really explore some of these ideas about how segregation was created, but also really talk about the consequences of that segregation, and these are some of the worst possible consequences. And you even say that when Ferguson happened is when we started to rediscover some of this history. So I was just wondering, can you just talk a little bit more about the effects of this kind of residential racial segregation?
Many of the most serious social problems we face in this country today have their foundations in residential segregation, which has never been addressed. For example, when we have violence between police and young African-American men, as in Ferguson or in Baltimore or in Milwaukee or in Charlotte. That can only happen. That can only take place in segregated neighborhoods where police are an occupying force, not a force that serves and protects, where young men are concentrated in areas where there are no jobs and no access to jobs and are hopeless. If they were living throughout the metropolitan area in integrated communities, police would not be able to have the kind of aggressive policies that they have towards young men. And young men wouldn't be standing around on the streets jobless with no opportunities. So those problems are attributable to residential segregation. The lack of mobility that we bemoan so much in public policy today is attributable to residential segregation in large part. African-American children who are poor, if they grow up in a low-income neighborhood, are much more likely to be poor as adults than equally poor African-American children who grow up in an integrated neighborhood and are more likely to be middle class as adults. So that problem, too, has its roots in residential segregation. So unless we learn this history and confront the need to undo it, to remedy the unconstitutional policies of the federal government, these enormous social problems are going to continue and could possibly get worse.
After a break, we'll hear the second part of Cosmo Garvin's conversation with Richard Rothstein. It's from September of 2017. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Now to continue the conversation between reporter Cosmo Garvin and Professor Richard Rothstein. Rothstein, in this part of the talk, addresses what happens when a constitutional right is violated.
If a constitutional right is violated, there's an obligation to remedy it. It's not a matter of choice. It's not a matter of popular majority. There's an obligation to remedy a violation of the Constitution if we're going to preserve our standing as a constitutional democracy. Realistically, we don't remedy constitutional violations unless there's, if not a majority, at least a substantial body of public support in favor of that remedy. And that's why learning this history is so critically important, because we're not about to begin remedying these violations as we are obligated to do unless there's popular support for remedies, and that will only come from learning this history.
You write in your book briefly about a policy under the Obama administration called the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule. And then the history of this policy to me is really interesting because it goes all the way back to the 60s and something called the Open Communities Policy. Can you talk a little bit about the history of that rule and what Obama tried to do to revive that policy?
In 1968, Richard Nixon was elected president, and it's illustrative of how well-known these constitutional violations were at the time. He was a Republican, and yet his Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, a fellow by the name of George Romney, the father of the recent presidential candidate, was determined to remedy these constitutional violations. And in the Nixon cabinet, as Secretary of Housing, he developed a program called Open Communities, in which he required suburbs to take steps to reverse the segregation that had been imposed by government. And he threatened to withhold federal funds for the things that suburbs get money for sidewalks, for sewers, for open space. Threatened to withhold federal funds from suburbs that did not repeal zoning ordinances that prohibited the construction of modest townhouses or homes on smaller lots, apartments, all zoning rules that were designed to keep African Americans out of suburbs. If suburbs didn't repeal those rules, if they didn't permit the construction of moderate income housing, he was going to withhold federal funds. And in fact, he did withhold funds from three suburbs. Baltimore County was one, a suburb of Michigan, Warren, that he was familiar with because he had been governor of Michigan, was a second, and another was an area in Ohio. He withheld federal funds from those three areas. President Nixon reined him in, canceled the Open Communities Program, and George Romney was forced out as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development as a result. Well, nothing serious was done to reverse residential segregation after that for many years. As you mentioned, the Obama administration, in its last years, developed a rule called the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule, which returned to this policy that had been attempted by George Romney, requiring suburbs to develop plans to desegregate. Ultimately, the threat was that if suburbs didn't develop plans to desegregate, federal funds could be withheld from them. But that was not to be because the Obama administration is no longer in office. And I think there's not political support for doing it because, again, people have forgotten the history. So even if Hillary Clinton had been elected and if she pursued the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing program, I don't think she would have been any more successful in doing so than George Romney had been 65 years earlier, because there's no political support for doing it, again, because we're so ignorant of this history.
The current HUD secretary, Ben Carson, I think, did you mention that he has been skeptical of this kind of rule?
His remarks are a good illustration of how we've forgotten this history. He characterized this rule as a form of social engineering, which he says he opposes because social engineering can have unintended consequences, which are problems. And he's absolutely right. What he fails to recognize is that the rule is not a form of social engineering. It's a form of undoing social engineering that was committed by the government in the mid-20th century. It's true there may be problems in enforcing it. There may be some unintended consequences. But that's a price we have to pay for remedying a constitutional violation.
Carson's response is really sort of the same objection you hear against any kind of policy for more inclusion. And that objection is, don't tell us what kind of neighborhoods we can live in. Don't tell us what kind of neighborhoods we can build. In a way, I guess you're saying, you know, it's too late.
What I'm saying is the federal government did tell us what kinds of neighborhoods we should live in and who should be our neighbors and what kinds of homes we can build. And it did so in an unconstitutional fashion. It's not as though people live in all white suburbs because they chose to live away from each other. It's because the federal government established these suburbs on an all-white basis. So these programs of reform are not an attempt to restrict people's choices. They're an attempt to undo a restriction that was created by government in the mid-20th century.
What are some of the remedies that you suggest?
Well, there are many remedies. The federal government today operates two programs, primarily directed at helping the housing needs of low-income families. One is called the Section 8 voucher program, the Housing Choice Voucher Program. It's a program that subsidizes the rents of low-income families so they can afford to rent apartments at market rates. In fact, though, that program serves primarily to reinforce segregation because landlords in most places, not in California, but in most places, are permitted to discriminate against Section 8 voucher holders, that is, not to rent to families that use these vouchers. And the vouchers aren't great enough, there's not enough money in them, to afford to rent in middle-class neighborhoods. They only are big enough to rent in already segregated neighborhoods. So the system reinforces segregation. The other program that the federal government runs is the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program, which is a run from the Department of Treasury and gives a tax credit to developers who build low-income housing. And again, this program reinforces segregation because developers prefer to build in already segregated neighborhoods where land is cheaper, where there's no community opposition, and where the project is visible to prospective tenants who will rent more quickly. Both of those programs could be reformed to place a priority on the opportunity of families to live in middle-class neighborhoods and high-opportunity neighborhoods where there's access to jobs and transportation and supermarkets and the other amenities of a normal middle-class American life. So those programs need to be reformed, and that's a short-term policy that could be implemented. The biggest housing program that the federal government runs is the mortgage interest deduction, which is granted to single-family homeowners, again, throughout the middle-class suburbs, many of them predominantly white. And we could begin to place restrictions on that mortgage interest deduction if it's used in communities that are segregated. Perhaps withhold the mortgage interest deduction from homes in those neighborhoods, perhaps put it in an escrow fund until the suburbs began to take steps to desegregate. So those are the kinds of reforms that we would begin to talk about if, again, we had a conversation that was based on an accurate knowledge of how this segregation happened.
I want to go back to your point about Section 8, which is, I understand there's some difference between different jurisdictions in California. There may be some different laws, but certainly here in Sacramento, landlords are free to not accept Section 8 vouchers and to discriminate against that source of income. So my guess is that's playing out here in Sacramento, and some of the reporting I've done suggests it can be very hard to find a place in any kind of neighborhood with lots of opportunities.
Yes, in most places in this country, most parts of this country, there are some places that have prohibited discrimination against Section 8 voucher holders, but in most parts of the country, landlords are free to discriminate. But there's a much more fundamental problem, and that is that even if landlords didn't discriminate, the number of apartments that are affordable to families with a Section 8 voucher in high-opportunity neighborhoods is very small. The voucher is not great enough because rents are higher in high-opportunity neighborhoods and middle-class neighborhoods than they are in segregated neighborhoods. And the voucher amounts are calculated by the government on an overall metropolitan-wide average so that if you have a voucher that's sufficient to rent an apartment at the average rent in a metropolitan area, it doesn't help you to rent an apartment in a middle-class area because the voucher is too small. In fact, the opposite is also true. The voucher amount is too high for segregated neighborhoods, and landlords are able to exploit families by charging more than market rates in segregated neighborhoods because of the way in which this voucher is calculated. In the last couple of weeks of the Obama administration, it adopted a rule which adjusted the voucher amounts so that families in many cities could get higher voucher amounts if they moved to high-opportunity neighborhoods. That rule has not been enforced by the Trump administration. In fact, the Trump administration sent a notice to housing agencies around the country telling them not to implement that rule because it said that the Trump budget was not going to provide sufficient funds to permit housing agencies to top up the vouchers in middle-class neighborhoods. So that's another area of reform that needs to be addressed.
So given our current political culture, what are the chances right now of sort of unraveling some of these old patterns?
Well, I think we can make a start. As you mentioned earlier, since the events in Ferguson and other cities, since the growth of the Black Lives Matter movement, there's much more discussion in this country about these issues than there was, say, 10 years ago. The discussion needs to continue. It needs to become more widespread. People need to become aware of this history to a greater extent. But I am hopeful that we can do it. You know, one of the things about this book of mine is that it did leave me with greater hope than I had before, because if we believe that all of these problems that result from residential segregation happen by accident, it's very hard to figure out how they can be undone. But if we understand that they were created by government, it's easier to understand that they can be undone by government. And so we have a way forward, and we need to extend the conversation throughout the country about it and build support for reform.
That was Cosmo Garvin's September 2017 conversation with Professor Richard Rothstein, senior fellow at the Haas Institute at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Rothstein had recently written his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. This is Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. This is Insight, celebrating 15 years on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. We're going to get another view of racial attitudes and segregation now from Georgetown University law professor Cheryl Cashin. She'd written a book titled Loving, Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. Professor Cashin joined us on Insight in October of 2017 to talk about the concept of whiteness and the changing American diversity.
In the colonial Virginia and other colonies, you could find indentured white servants, bonded or enslaved, black people and indigenous people all toiling together to produce tobacco. And they would work together, get drunk together, sometimes have sex, sometimes marry, run off together, and rebel together. There were a number of revolts in the colonies among struggling people who didn't like the oppression and the harsh conditions imposed upon them by the economic elites. And so what happened is, particularly because indentured servants, who were far and away the largest population among bonded people, white indentured people, they were an unruly class. And so the people who could afford to own a person or a contract attached to a person decided to transition to black chattel slavery. But they had to break up this idea of alliance. And so, you know, in the first slave codes, they inserted penalties for helping someone run away, for interracial sex, for interracial marriage. And this color line gets created for the economic, capitalistic reason of wanting to create an institution, slavery, that would be more efficacious.
With economic forces and power being some of the reason behind this, a lot of people believe that nationalists in U.S. government today are still about those forces more than they're actually about race.
Every time in American history, from the 1600s to today, that you have an assertion or a reassertion of whiteness, there is an economic story, frankly, one of betrayal. The thing that elites in this country have always most feared is that struggling whites and people of color would get together in politics and demand more of them. You know, there's this phrase out here, nationalism, alt-right economic nationalism. People can deny that racial dog whistling trying to divide people is part of the politics of this, but I think a lot of people can see it plainly. You know, winking at people who openly avow white supremacy, or, you know, suggesting that there's some very fine people among the people carrying tiki torches, that is trading in and playing to this idea of white nationalism, you know, whatever you want to call it. There's no question that that's part of the politics of the day. But what heartens me is that I think the majority of Americans forcefully reject this and do not like that kind of dark, ugly, divide and conquer politics.
I want to get to what you just pointed to, which is
cultural dexterity. But I'm first of all going to ask about the title, Loving, because that reflects on the Supreme Court case that hit its 50th anniversary this summer, Loving versus Virginia, and why that case changed the history that you first started talking about.
So Loving versus Virginia, 1967, is the first case in the history of the Supreme Court where the court says this law was about white supremacy. And we can't have that anymore, and we're striking it down. And what was the law? It was a law that told whites they could not marry non-whites. Richard Loving, who absolutely loved his mixed-race African-American and indigenous wife, this regime, which was central, frankly, to the Jim Crow regime, told whites they couldn't marry, love, play checkers with, much less ally in politics. God bless Richard and Mildred Loving. They went through a 9-year battle to get this struck down just so they could live as man and woman in Virginia. And that puts to bed the last plank of Jim Crow, anti-miscegenation laws. But the true import of the case, it's only beginning to really be felt as social barriers to interracial mixing have been coming down. What I feature in the book in the last 50 years, five forms of intimacy have been growing apace in a way where people are acquiring what I call cultural dexterity: marriage, cohabitation, dating, transracial adoption, and the virtual experience of characters like the family in Black-ish, where you can develop an affectionate tie to the character or, say, a black president in ways that humanize a different race for you. What people acquire, cultural dexterity, it's the opposite of color blindness. It's the ability to see difference and accept it, if not love it. What I argue, and then let me say, thank you, Californians, you give me hope. In that last chapter of the book, I studied carefully the transition of California. California went in a 20-year period from being majority white to gridlocked, to majority-minority, to functional again in its politics. It was a confluence of forces that had California reach a tipping point where, first, a critical mass of white people in the state acquired dexterity, higher rates of interracial intimacy in California than the rest of the country, and then other forces, the dying off of older whites who grew up expecting to be dominant and had a harder time accepting California's racial transitions, the emergence of rapidly growing communities of color, particularly Hispanics and Asians, who experienced discrimination and didn't like it, and particularly didn't like Pete Wilson's anti-immigrant politics, and got more engaged with politics, not just registering to vote, but also running for office. This created what's called a coalition of the ascendant. And now no one can get elected to statewide office in California with the kind of mean-spirited, anti-immigrant, dog-whistling politics we've seen in national politics. We are in a period where a lot of people are acquiring dexterity, not just through interracial intimacy, but also just by watching what's happening. They're acquiring the ability to see, name, and talk about racism. And all of the social science predicts that when people do that, they are more likely to engage in collective action to fight it.
The U.S. Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, in writing the Loving case, actually used that phrase, white supremacy.
And Earl Warren, a Californian, also the author of Brown v. Board, when he was Attorney General of California in the 40s, he actually supported the Japanese internment. So he evolved a lot as Chief Justice by saying aloud, this is about white supremacy. This is at a time when there are race riots across the country in 1967. I think he's trying gently in his way to help cure the country of its mental illness, white supremacy, by saying it aloud and saying, we can't have a country premised on this ancient idea anymore.
What has the response been as you travel and talk about this and make your case?
I've given talks in the South, the Northeast. My trip to Sacramento is my first trip west. it's been overwhelmingly positive. People are hungry for not just hope, but a sense for how we can be better. People have thanked me, like grandparents who come to me and say, you know, I have a biracial grandson. My daughter adopted an African-American baby. We've had a crash course in cultural dexterity, and this book so resonates with me. I think most humans understand the basic emotion of love. Love can make you do uncomfortable things. And this rising interracial intimacy is forcing a lot of people to see things that they didn't otherwise do see and to empathize.
And to add a California fact to this, you write that now nearly one in four newly married couples in California are interracial couples. And is that quite a bit higher than the national average?
One in five newly married couples nationally are between people of a different race. I'm not saying that interracial intimacy in and of itself is going to solve all our problems. I'm just saying that it's helping to spread cultural dexterity and seeing. But activism among culturally dexterous people and people who want our country to work and promote the common good is required.
You also make the point, too, that as older generations pass on and younger generations become the dominant population level in the country, that just naturally there's going to be a shift in thinking approach and policy in governing.
60% of whites under 30 agree with the Black Lives Matter movement's critique of law enforcement. Their perspectives are very different from that of their grandparents. And I actually think this is why some elements are paying to try to introduce very conservative ideas on college campuses. I think they're worried about the open-mindedness of young people. And I am so betting on this generation and the generation after that to help appeal to our best values.
Professor Cashin, somebody is listening to you and wondering about your own background.
I'm African American. I identify as such. I descend from a white slave owner who had a common law marriage, as far as we can tell, relationship with a mixed race woman of color. And there are other interracial couples a couple of generations back in my gene pool. My parents, who were both activists in the sit-in movement in Huntsville, Alabama, and in politics in Alabama, actively recruited liberal whites to join their cause. So, you know, we were the only Black family at the Unitarian Church. I grew up around activists of all colors working together to make things better in Alabama. And I've always known that there are good people of all colors and that if you find your allies and work together, you can make any situation better.
Georgetown University Law Professor Cheryl Cashin, her book is Loving, and we have a link to her 2017 New York Times essay entitled How Interracial Love is Saving America. It's at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Colson Whitehead was on the cover of Time magazine in July of 2019. His new book, The Nickel Boys, set in the Jim Crow era, came out that month, too. People were still talking about his remarkable novel from 3 years earlier, The Underground Railroad. That book won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. Colson Whitehead became one of only 6 writers to ever have won both awards for the same novel, and only the second writer of color in that category, joining Alice Walker for The Color Purple. Colson Whitehead was in the Insight studio in March of 2017 after the National Book Award news, but before the Pulitzer Prize had been awarded.
I had a contract for a book that was maybe a little bit obvious. It was about a Brooklyn writer going through a midlife crisis, and that sounds kind of dumb in retrospect. And so it seemed maybe if the, you know, if I've been avoiding this book about slavery for so long, maybe the hard thing is the thing I should be doing. And I finally committed to it, and I think it worked out pretty well.
Your very first book, though, The Intuitionist, did address race and race relations in a way. But I've heard you say that before, that the concept of slavery either seemed too big or scared you off.
I knew in order to do the ideal justice, I would have to just go deeply, you know, so much into the history of slavery and how it worked. And it is very daunting. I mean, I think, like a lot of people my age, I first came to slavery through Roots. My parents made us all watch it in front of the TV. I studied it in college, American history. But coming to it as a 40-something with kids, it's very different. You know, imagining my kids seeing me beaten, their mother assaulted, sold off, tortured, and vice versa. You know, the stakes were much higher, and I didn't feel just psychologically ready to delve into that for a long time.
I've heard you say that your parents would teach you about big concepts that way, that watching Roots on TV must have been a way a lot of American families accessed history.
I think, you know, we don't learn a lot about slavery or a lot of different things in elementary school. I think we sort of fail when it comes to addressing the histories of marginalized people. I mean, it's sad that television and films do become a way of starting a conversation, but at least that conversation is getting started.
Cora, in your book, gives us the experience of slavery. There have been many stories recently, our contemporary movies and books talk a lot about slavery. And by the way, why do you think that is? Why do you think now?
It's hard for me to step back, but I mean, it is actually really few. I mean, it's like two TV shows and a movie and my book. So I don't think so.
At the moment.
Yeah.
But when you broaden it out over the last couple years.
I think in terms of, you know, books and movies, I think that there's more African-American artists. And I think eventually you're going to address your own history. And so I think there's more of us having access in terms of through more TV opportunities and film opportunities. I think it's more just numbers than necessarily something in the culture.
So Cora, in her escape, goes state to state on this Underground Railroad, literally with rails and cars. And each state delivers her to a different, what, portal?
The Underground Railroad is a literal railroad. And then the second sort of complicating thing in the story is that each state that Cora goes through is a different state of American possibility, sort of like Gulliver's Travels, critiquing a different part of our country's history. South Carolina has its own political scheme, North Carolina. And in that way, the book's not just about someone running north, escaping slavery. It's about different parts of American history and race and freedom. It's not a straightforward historical novel. I'm not like in some historical novelist union where I have to tell the truth. For me, as a fiction writer, making up things is the fun part. And so my theory was that I wouldn't stick to the facts, but I would stick to the truth and sort of a larger American truth as opposed to one individual story of escape.
But she's such a gripping character. And the people around her that spend time or history with her, Coulson, get taken in. I read and hear people talking about the book, and these characters get embedded in us. And I felt very invested in where her life is going to go. And I get the sense that for you, the story was about the railroad and the metaphor and the bigger picture of what was happening. So how is it to hear how personally your characters are affecting people?
It's one thing to have a big idea, but you also want the characters who engage with that idea to be credible and relatable, or you want to empathize and sympathize with them. And so in trying to figure out what kind of personality could escape slavery, you know, tens of millions of people were in bondage and only a small fraction were able to escape. A bigger number were able to conceive but couldn't pull it off. But what kind of bravery does it take to leave the plantation knowing that you could be killed if you're captured? And that means having a really dynamic and brave and complex main character. And so that's Cora. And, you know, her journey is not just going to the north, it's also becoming a person, because when you're a slave, you're an object, you have no agency, you're a piece of property. And as she goes from state to state, going more and more north, she becomes more of a person, and her idea of herself gets enlarged. and her idea of freedom changes, and the reader is along for the ride.
Would you read from one of the jobs she gets and put it in context?
So she's in South Carolina, and South Carolina has a seemingly very benevolent attitude towards black people. They've taken slaves out of bondage, bought them from their masters, given them housing and jobs and education. And in this section, Cora is working in a museum, the Museum of Natural History, and she's in an exhibit where she's a human player in a diorama of different parts of history, one about Africa, one about life on a slave ship, and one about plantation life. And of course, it's very sanitized because we don't necessarily look at history head on. So she walks around as a character in these different sort of tableaus of American history. The stuffed coyotes on their stands did not lie, Cora supposed, and the ant hills and rocks in the exhibits told the truth of themselves. But the white exhibits contained as many inaccuracies and contradictions as Cora's three habitats. There had been no kidnapped boys swabbing the decks and earning pats on the head from white kidnappers. The enterprising African boy on the slave ship diorama, whose fine leather boots she wore, would have been chained below decks, swabbing his body in his own filth. Slave work was sometimes spinning thread, yes. Most times it was not. No slave had ever keeled over dead at a spinning wheel or been butchered for a tangle. But no one wanted to speak on the true disposition of the world, and no one wanted to hear it. Certainly not the white monsters on the other side of the exhibit at this very moment, pushing their greasy snouts against the window, sneering and hooting. Truth was a changing display in a shop window, manipulated by hands when you weren't looking, alluring and ever out of reach. And so as she gets this job and becomes more of a person, she can critique the kind of version of history that the museum is presenting. And dramatizing that is very important to me, having her become less of an object and more of a person.
Before that, when she's in Georgia, you have a mother-daughter-grandmother relationship. You have the three women who grew up and were on that plantation and their shared possession being the garden. So that's her small world, and that's where we're first introduced. Then you describe South Carolina. She goes next to North Carolina, and the way that state is handling slavery is completely different.
If South Carolina is a seemingly benevolent white paternalistic state, North Carolina's scheme is that it's a white supremacist state. And so I take the sort of natural progression of what happens with Jim Crow laws, separate but equal, and draw in some imagery from Nazi Germany. And take a little bit of Oregon history. Oregon was founded as a white separatist state, and African Americans couldn't live, own, or work there until 1925, which seems crazy. You know, in playing with history, I can take different moments from America, from Europe, and put them in conversation with each other. The book does have a larger conversation with how the world works and how oppression works. In Nazi Germany, the racial theorists were reading the American eugenicists from the 19th century, and they got a lot of their ideas from how we oppressed people in the 19th century. For me, oppression is one continuum.
You're often asked in interviews if current events were shaping your writing of the book, but I think the question should be reversed, and that was really, how were those events, the events you write about in their real form, informing what's happened since or what's happening today?
It is very strange, because when the book came out, people would ask me, oh, was this influenced by Black Lives Matter or what happened in Ferguson? And for me, it's no. I mean, we do have these periodic conversations about police brutality every couple of years, and then we forget about them, and then something else happens, and that seems to be a process of how we deal with them. And so it felt very separate. And then after the election of Trump, it seems we have a renewed engagement with white supremacy. So the last few months have changed definitely my interpretation of the book. I thought I was maybe closing a conversation about a certain time in our history, and of course we move forward and we move back and we move forward, and you know, we take these lumbering steps into our better selves.
Throughout the book, there are slave ads. Are those real?
They are real. A couple years ago, University of North Carolina digitized a lot of runaway slave ads from North Carolina newspapers from the 1820s. In the same way that if your dog runs away, you might put an ad in the laundromat. If your slave runs away, you put an ad in a newspaper saying, $10 reward for my slave, Bessie. She has these kind of distinguishing marks. As a fiction writer, I like making things up, but the language of the ads was so perfect, I could never compete. They're only eight lines, but they contain so much. Bessie ran away for no reason at all. And of course, we know why she ran away. She has a mark on her arm from a burn. And of course, we think, how did she get that burn? It really, for me, made clear just how so many people were implicated in slavery, even if you didn't own slaves. If you're a blacksmith, you're making chains, obviously, but also the wheel rims for the carts that bring cotton to market in these new cotton routes that are springing up. You're making the nails for the houses that are coming up in these new communities. So a blacksmith is implicated. A newspaper man is implicated. And it really needed so much of the country, slavery did, in order to keep it going.
I can hear people wondering out loud, what about your own history? What do you know generations back in your own family?
There's a strand of my family that I can trace through Virginia. And since the book has come out, I've had various family members who decided to fill me in because I've said I didn't know that much. In Virginia, there's a biracial indentured servant who was sold to James Madison and then had 8 kids, and that was a big branch of the family. But from my father's side, the line dies off around 1910, and obviously we didn't come here on student visas. They live and die in Florida or Alabama. Under what conditions? What were their names? You know, half of my family's history is lost in that void of slavery.
Colson Whitehead's story from the Underground Railroad is in pre-production for an upcoming Amazon Prime series titled Underground. His latest book is The Nickel Boys. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruiak. Insight is produced by Cody Drabble and Kate Gonzalez. We had help from Helen Barrington and Antonio Muniz. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.